This is Central Standard on KCUR. We're streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. When you think of the ideal man, the manly man, what picture forms in your mind's eye? Is it about a particular build and face, an outward style that declares masculinity? Is it a certain trait, athleticism or toughness or stoicism? Or is it a way of relating to others with responsibility, perhaps, or leadership? Do you think being a real man means being the opposite of what other people expect? These are complicated questions, and the answers change from generation to generation, maybe even from year to year. Today we're exploring masculinity and what it means to be a man here and now. Joining us to talk about it first is Dr. Elizabeth Berkshire. She is a psychological anthropologist and adjunct professor at UMKC in Rockhurst. She teaches classes on contemporary understandings of masculinity. Beth, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So later we'll hear from a man who has participated in a contemporary effort to strengthen and redefine manhood in today's world. But first, Beth, how do we even begin to define masculinity?
Well, first of all, we have to locate masculinity within a framework of understanding. And I think that one of the things to start with is to think about masculinity as the social, cultural, and political expression of maleness, which, of course, opens up a whole new can of worms
sure. In
terms of what is man or what is maleness. And but maybe backing up a little bit is to think about the notion of real man versus really men and open that up again to ask the question, can we talk openly about men as gendered subjects in the same way that we've talked about women as gendered subjects?
Well, let's talk about that distinction you're making, real men versus really men. What do you mean by that?
Well, when we think about the difference between, say, gender and sex, just in terms of naming, gender is often thought of as the masculinity or femininity of a given life. Sex is used to refer to biological maleness or femaleness, and we confer masculinity and femininity most typically through the notion of sex. So biological maleness has been affiliated then with masculinity, whereas biological femaleness is affiliated with femininity. But that's a debate, a question about,
And obviously that's just the starting place, right? I mean, we obviously go far beyond the anatomical designation in what we think it means to be male.
Absolutely, because gender and sex are both binary constructs, and they're also hierarchical social taxonomies. And so they divide us into kinds of people that occupy different positions of social power. And that's where it begins to get interesting and to think about what kinds of things really do define masculinity.
Well, and in layperson's terms, what are those things? What are some of the things that in today's world we look at and say, this is what makes a man or a masculine person masculine?
Well, in your opening, you talked about some of the questions that come up, and it's really interesting to think about the changes over time. You know, at the turn of the century, we would have been talking about moral issues. We would have shaped masculinity in terms of morality, and issues of being a good man would be tied to that. And today we've seen a transformation over time where we're beginning to shape notions of masculinity around a number of different things. But there's definitely a larger emphasis placed on physicality. Tied, the body is being used to be a referent. And so, you know, Christopher Brew wrote a book called Hard Boiled Masculinities, and it's a wonderful example of how that has become a rubric for understanding whether or not you are a member of the clan of men or not, whether or not your body projects a kind of physical hardness versus mm-hmm. softness. These are themes that come up in masculinity and femininity comparisons. You know, the idea is that there's supposed to be a difference between masculinity and femininity implied by the very existence of the two kind of oppositional binary terms. So you've got hard, soft, you've got interior, exterior, you've got emotional versus lack of affect.
And has it always been that way, Beth? I mean, you look at sort of paintings from the Renaissance or even sculptures from much before that. And although there might be a certain athleticism portrayed in the men in some of those portrayals, I would say it's often a softer look to the men than what we typically think of as manliness in today's culture.
Right, exactly. Jackson Katz created a very interesting documentary that's still used in classrooms and in cultural settings, and called Tough Guys, G-U-I-S-E. Mm. And what he does is he maps the transition of even the action figure, a boy's action figure. The fact that we even call a figure that a boy would play with an action figure tells us something. It's there's a really wonderful article that I use in the classroom with students called Barbie Girls versus Sea Monsters, and it's about a group of soccer players, boys and girls teams, and just the names that they associate with. But back to the issue of action figures, we've seen a remarkable increase in the just the dimension of, say, a bicep over time. So a new emphasis being placed on an exterior, really packaged masculinity, which is, you know, why he refers to this notion of hard-boiled masculinities. But it's not a new term. It's a term that grew out of the 30s and 40s and moved in the hard-boiled detective novel moving forward.
I wonder, I mean, you mentioned that there's both biological factors as well as social and cultural factors. Are there some things that are just different? I mean, are there certain traits, even if we look at the animal world or we look at males in other species, are there certain things that do in fact make males males?
Well, if you want to talk about the biology, we can talk scientifically about male bodies and female bodies. But theorists in my world tend to talk, we reject the idea of a fixed natural masculinity because most of us are taught to believe that the differences we see and experience between the so-called, in quote, sexes are inherent features of our existence. This is not easy to wrap your head around. Mm-hmm. But it also opens up the opportunity to think politically about these terms. And Julia Epstein has said, and I think this is a wonderful quote, that the differences between men and of the differences that we see between men and women, if these differences are natural, why must their enforcement be coercive? And why must males and females be forced to assume the roles that they are, and she puts in quotes, naturally supposed to play? So the idea in my work is really to open up a conversation about the idea that, you know, men really are asked to play a role, and we shape that role through our definitions of what we ascribe to be masculinity, and that changes over time, as you said. But it is a kind of confinement. It's setting the parameters of existence, and your biological maleness then is what positions you to respond to that, to answer the question, are you a man or a woman?
You know, you and I both represent sort of a Western cultural approach to these issues by where we've grown up. I wonder if we lived in an Asian culture, an African culture, if we would have very different presuppositions about what masculinity is.
Well, I do think that yes, we would. There's a question that is always looming. You know, I participate in the American Men's Studies Association, which is actually – it's sort of a misnomer because it's a very global organization. I have scholars in the field of men's studies from all over who are grappling with these issues. And we are able to talk about the same themes, and yet certain things may be highlighted in one culture versus the other. And this debate about whether or not we can even talk about masculinity in the singular, does this exist, versus maybe we should always be talking about masculinities, that mm-hmm. there is no one way to be a man, and yet the very notion of being a man is a singular question.
Can you give me some specifics? Like how in an Asian culture or an African culture might I see being a man, quote unquote?
Okay. There was a wonderful graduate student that I met who did a study of he looked at Jackie Chan, of all folks, and his films here in the United States versus his films in China. And he introduced the notion of wen and wu, and he borrows from Chinese theorists of masculinity and who argue we cannot use the same conceptions that are being used in the United States to talk about masculinity because they don't apply. So the very idea that what I think was so fascinating about his work looking at Jackie Chan was that in his films in China, the idea of the scholar, the person who writes in a particular way loomed large, just as large as the physicality. We don't have that same one in Wu dichotomy in the American sort of model of prototypical, I would say, masculinity, or the masculinity that gets the most airtime, so to speak.
And, you know, we're talking a lot about sort of physical or even behavioral aspects, but we haven't talked a lot about the emotional sort of side of what it means to be a man. And often this is where a lot of attention is paid on a contemporary basis in sort of American conversations about masculinity. We'll talk more about that, in fact, in the second half of the show today. But I'm curious for your sense, where did we get the idea that men are supposed to be stone-cold, unemotional providers? And I guess when did that idea start to change some, too?
Well, I do think that the you know, within our own frame, the turn of the century and the shift in the Industrial Revolution brought about a new relationship between men and labor, men and family, and it completely altered the way that men's identities were shaped within those larger institutional, you know, arenas. And so, you know, when you shift from an entrepreneurial model where a man is his own sort of leader in a sense, which is very stereotypical to think about, but then move that in the direction of a managerial model where the man's labor no longer belongs to himself. He becomes beholden to a larger system. Issues of individuality and autonomy become more relevant to bring to the forefront. And so we began to see a real emphasis on what had before been working class. Masculinity has become more of a mainstream model. And so and Christopher Brew's work in Hardboiled Masculinities addresses this as well more fully, but really talking about the issue of athletics become a big component of how one expresses masculinities. Now, simultaneously, the fact that we're talking about all this physicality, we're also by negation talking about the emotional construct that's supposed to coexist with that. So that's what I find really fascinating, is that the physicality, the emphasis on physicality, is a way, a statement about the lack of affect or the suppression of affect. I think suppression is a better word, because lack suggests that there's some sort of, you know, a priori basis there. But my work with men and talking with students in the classroom with men, you know, completely blows that notion out of the water. It turns out that men's emotional experiences are just as full and deep and meaningful. It's whether or not they are authorized to actually put that on the table and share it in settings that that police that and control it.
I guess I wonder too, is there a historical inaccuracy in sort of that assumption that that's how it used to be? I mean, is it really true that 100 years ago or 200 years ago men were unemotional and not really the caregivers in
their
families?
Oh yeah, no, I don't think so. I think that we build myths, and we build myths that are convenient for the time. And you know, overarching all of this is the big question: why? Mm-hmm. You know, why if we agree with the idea that masculinities and femininities change over time, we should be asking why. What is it that we need of these models of existence? You know, they are social taxonomies, and as I said, they do set up hierarchical systems. But, you know, the big question is why.
You know, there's another question, I guess, that strikes me given today's contemporary society. We obviously live in a world where gay men are more accepted, and I wonder if that has changed how or maybe it's intersected with these evolving understandings of masculinity.
I think so. But I also believe that we continue to have a lot of work to do around the feminization of gay men. So the idea of negating a certain level of masculinity tied to that identity, I think, is fascinating to think about, because that expression of being in the world hasn't really gained full status under the rubric umbrella of masculinity. And that, I think, culturally is telling us something about the status afforded to a heteronormative model of masculinity.
heteronormative, meaning an assumption about of heterosexuality on the part of men.
Right, exactly. Trujillo, a theorist, talks about hegemonic masculinity in U.S. culture.
And say what that means.
So it would be sort of the prevailing, most influential frame that little boys are born into the world and they are expected to live their life according to, and then men would continue to. And he names the following ideas: that when power is defined in terms of physical force and control, when it is defined through occupational achievement in an industrial capitalist society, when masculinity is represented in terms of familial patriarchy, when it's symbolized by daring romantic frontiersmen of yesteryear and the present day outdoorsmen, you know, this relationship to the land, when masculinity is heterosexually defined and centered on representations tied to that. So I hope that helps to set it up, to frame it.
Sure. Well, and that's a good place for us to take a break, as we've sort of established a picture of what it is we're talking about by masculinity. I want to invite our listeners to help us flesh out that picture as you understand it. What does it mean to you for someone to be a man? We want to hear from men and from women. Do you feel like society is finally getting this right, or do you think something important has been lost in recent decades? How have you seen positive changes come about in the lives and identity of men? Call us with your story, your experience, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We also invite you to email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. When we come back, we'll hear about the Mankind Project. It's one of several organizations designed to challenge and mentor men into understanding themselves and their manhood more deeply. We'll talk to a mentor in that program and continue our conversation about what it means these days to be a man. Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Masculinity in today's world may feel like something of a moving target, but what is a man to do if he wants to live more deeply into his own understanding of his place as husband, father, son, friend, his identity as a man? We've been talking with Dr. Beth Berkshire of UMKC, and now we are also joined by Charles Gruber. He's an elder with the Mankind Project. Charles, welcome to the program.
Thank you kindly. Pleasure to be here.
Again, want to invite our listeners to the conversation. If you want to share your experience or your story or your questions about manliness and masculinity in today's world, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Charles, tell us exactly what is the Mankind Project that you're involved with.
It's a basket in which to collect the fruit.
Give us a little more than that.
Okay. It's an organization that's started in 1985, and it's an initiatory organization of men who want to help men find out who they are and how to express themselves. And there are currently over 50,000 initiates in the worldwide program of what we call the Mankind Project.
And what do initiates do? What does it mean to be involved in the program?
Well, there's two aspects. There's many aspects of it. The beginning aspects of it are that in the Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence area called the Heartland MKP Center Project, we have a number of integration groups. We meet on one night during the week. Separately with anywhere from 5 to 10 men. And the first integration group I went to 10 years ago, I walked in and the man who was to become my mentor said, well, tonight we're going to talk about emotional literacy. And my head exploded because I had never put those two words together. To know and name what I'm feeling so that I can look at how I respond to those feelings. And I've been working with teaching and learning that for a long time. And the other aspect is if men want to get take part in an intense adventure weekend, 48 hours long, where we dive into the stuff of what it means to be a man and why it is that we have such trouble getting to that answer, then they're invited to find out about that.
What led you to go to that group that very first time in the first place? I mean, who says to themselves, I need to go be with some other men and talk about being a man?
I was feeling pretty depressed, and I'm a realtor, and one of my clients said, hey, I just did this weekend you won't believe it, blah, 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 blah. And I didn't even get the name right. I said, I'm in. And I went and did the weekend, and then we had the opportunity to join in an ongoing process. And the depression has not become my motivator. The learning about it has become my motivator. And I didn't do that till I was 58, and I'm 68 now. And so in the community, I'm treated as an elder formally, and I get a chance to mentor men and some women too.
What does that mentoring involve? What do you do?
Listen, ask questions.
And what's the goal? Where are you trying to move someone from A to B? What's the B?
A is oftentimes I'm stuck. Mm-hmm. B is I'm feeling courageous and vulnerable. How do I get from A to B? And the answer is sometimes we can do it ourselves, but I was never trained in that when I was young. And so I've been learning that I can encourage men to tell their story without having to protect themselves.
You know, it's interesting. We've been talking for this most of this hour about what it means to be a man. We've talked a lot about cultural images, whether it be how action figures look or muscularity and physicality. Mm-hmm. I don't hear you talking about that at all as what this program focuses on in terms of what it means to be a man.
Oh, thank you. That's just a physiological – that's not just. It's what we're – if you look at TV, sometimes I like to turn off the sound and just look at the commercials, mm-hmm. and it just says it all. Mm-hmm. about how we're controlled to be where we're going.
But what it says you think is wrong.
No, it's just saying what it says. What it doesn't say is that we have a choice whether to believe that stuff or to explore on our own what it feels like to be a man and find other men who are exploring that on their own and to come up with some ways to support each other. Now, there are... It's interesting you mentioned about the archetypes, Beth, about the physicality and the sports figures. We study archetypes through from a Jungian place of the lover, the warrior, the magician, and the king, and the mature and immature aspects of all of those. And that's much broader.
The lover, the warrior, the magician, and the king.
That's right.
And are those different men fall into different categories, or are those parts of every man?
They're parts of every man. Which part is playing a role in how I'm thinking and feeling and acting right now?
Interesting. I want to invite our listeners again to be part of the conversation. Your experiences of masculinity, whether as a man or as a woman, whether it was positive or negative, 816-235-2888 is the number to call. And Charles, we do want to hear more of your story and about the Mankind Project. There will be a link, by the way, to more information at our website, which is kcur.org. Barbara in Parkville is joining us. Barbara, good morning.
Good morning. This is great to have an opportunity to bring up a thought that I have all the time. And since the main topic is men, I'll frame it around a sensitivity to the male, but it has to do with customs and dress. And here's where it comes to my mind all the time is when you see a television program featuring like a host, a male and a female host, and the male, they're sitting on two high stools to talk to you. The high stool, so like the woman couldn't really each reach the ground with her toes if she had to. But the man is dressed with a long sleeve shirt and a collar buttoned all the way up tight and a kind of a rope tied tightly around his neck, and then a lined jacket of some heavy material, long pants, socks.
I think we see where this is going, Barbara.
Shoes. Yeah, and the woman is in a low cut sleeveless dress that's about 7 inches above her knees. And so the guy can sit on the stool with his legs 16 inches apart, and the woman better keep her knees, her legs crossed. But why are men, and women have evolved in fashion a lot more than women do. This isn't all that far from the West coat, the tight-fitting coats, and the ruffled collars that came up very tight around the man's neck.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And everything covered all the way down from the neck to the tip of the toe.
Yeah, well, let's ask Beth Berkshire, who is an anthropologist, about this very topic. And Barbara raises a really interesting point, Beth, that we haven't really got to yet, that a lot of our notions of masculinity are most obviously observed in contrast with our notions of femininity.
That's right. And but we're also talking, what you're bringing up is the way that we enact gender. And it leads back to Epstein's quote that, you know, if this is so natural, why do we have to coercively sort of control it? And mm-hmm. one of the ways we do that is through dress. I mean, one of the first questions we ask expecting parents is, you know, is it a boy or a girl? And then we assign a particular color, particularly in our culture, to further define that, and then we move out from there. And what you're addressing, this really interesting juxtaposition of male and female personifications, it's tied the idea that sex assignment leads to assigned clothing habits, mm-hmm. and then that leads to assigned roles in speech. You know, the fact that the woman is dressed in a particular way, in a provocative way, that sort of gives us a signal of what her role is, also alters the way that we hear her or listen to her versus how we're listening to him. And so I would imagine that her distress, the caller's distress, Barbara's distress over this, is tied to the idea that the woman is discounted in this, you know, male-female visual display.
Yeah. Barbara, thanks for the call. 816-235-2888 is the number. Reed is calling us from Lawrence, Kansas. Reed, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
Hey, yeah, I just wanted to bring up a kind of a point that's been bugging me as of recently. You know, as of more recently, I'm kind of caught in the middle of something. There we go. All right. You know, something that I've run into a decent amount of time is, you know, I really like helping people, whether it be like holding open a door or anything like that. But I noticed there's sort of been a sort of culture shift or change recently where, you know, a lot of guys kind of are now almost vilified in a way. Like, I'm afraid to, you know, help out a woman or more specifically like kids. Without, you know, being automatically assumed or profiled as like a pedophile or even something even worse, you know.
You're saying that a man who is friendly to women or friendly to children is somehow seen as dangerous or strange.
Exactly. You know, also being here in Lawrence in a college town, you know, or even just trying to have a conversation with, you know, somebody or meeting new people, which is one of my favorite things to do. You know, a lot of times it's automatically assumed that I'm only interested in, you know, sort of getting them home or the worst things instead of, you know, what I really want to do, which is just meet people and learn new things about them.
Yeah, I appreciate that question, Reed, very much. And let me ask our guests to comment on that. Have notions of masculinity gone to the place where men behaving in ways that are apparently not appropriate masculinity, whether that means being friendly or helpful or kind, are then seen as somehow strange or dangerous?
What I get being 68 mm-hmm. and having a white beard is that younger and young people for the last 10 years have been opening doors for me. And at first I was feeling patronized.
Mm-hmm.
And now, and for a long time, I've said, thank you very much. And I hold the door open for them. And when I'm driving down 23rd Street in Lawrence and somebody waves me into the line of traffic and I bow to them, I'm saying, thank you for supporting who I am, and I let them do it. So uh-huh. So the caller said, Reed said, I'm afraid I'm being put into a box.
Mm-hmm.
And my response to that is the box is inside of you, so just open it up.
Beth, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that when Reed gave his example of opening the door, we typically call that chivalry.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's interesting to think about is that has been opened up within the field of masculinities. There are folks who are debating the double-edged sword of it, that on the one hand, it's an identity that's shaped around giving, caring. On the other, the traditional model of chivalry is a kind of a heteronormative model, a male, female, and it's always subjecting the female into a position of needing help. And, you know, what's interesting to think about as a woman is, how do I find myself in a position where I actually welcome the help without putting myself in a demoted position. So right. when I say double-edged sword, I'm saying that chivalry today proposes a number of issues because I want to be taken care of, as all human beings do. And but the traditional model of chivalry sets it up so that, as I think Reed is recognizing in some of the responses to his attempts to care for people, it gets shoved back into this notion of being a man and setting the stage or establishing positions of power.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you talk about your own role as a woman in sort of acknowledging these things inside yourself as well as in society. I guess I'd ask both of you, do you think there is a role that women and girls have in today's world in helping men form emotionally intelligent or mature understandings of themselves?
It may be the only job they have.
Well, and how do they do it?
They start with dropping the question, how do you feel? To which there's only two answers, fine or not so good, and asking the question, what do you feel?
And asking men to be more articulate and thoughtful about their feelings.
Yeah, and then honoring that. Hmm. So I think that's the beginning of it.
Great. How else, Beth?
Well, I'm going to be radical about this. I think that we are all walking around with all of the understanding of masculinity and femininity and certain aspects of ourselves based on our biological sex allow us to be in the world according to one or the other. So, in other words, I am just as much a carrier of masculinity as men are.
In
a sense, because I'll give you a wonderful example, and my husband will just deal with it when he may or may not hear the story. But it's a wonderful example of my son ran across the room and jumped into his lap, and my husband went down onto the floor because he was in incredible pain because he was kneed. And my immediate reaction, as a person who works in this field and is incredibly open to thinking broadly, was suck it up. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling this story because I think it's important, because so much of my identity as a woman was tied into my husband staying in his role. And when I saw him down on the floor in serious pain and quite vulnerable, I had a reaction, which was, no, buddy, get back into your role so that I can continue to be me relative to you.
Be a man.
So in a sense, but because, you know, we were able to then take it the next step, because I was able to then say, I cannot believe that just came out of me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in other issues too, I also carry the opposite, which is I could be in a karate test and doing calisthenics and next to my male peer and have a voice come from within me. And this actually happened, where I said to myself, wishing I could say it to the sensei, give me a break, I'm a woman. Mm-hmm. You see, so we carry these things. But I know what he's carrying. He knows what I'm carrying. In other words, we're all really, we're really quite aware on a certain level.
Your comment about each person having masculinity and femininity within them raises, I think, another question that's been very much in the news recently involving transgender people. There's parents who are now allowing or even encouraging their children who are born anatomically male, let's say, to dress as girls and live their lives as girls if that's how they identify. Does this reflect more of this evolving notion that masculinity and femininity are not set in stone, as it were?
Yes, in a way. But I also think it reinforces a binary model, because what we're talking about is transgendered. So and even the queer identity affiliated with that is really about blurring binary lines. So in a way, these are just extensions. We have more permissibility for different sort of representations of that binary model. There is a wonderful program that can be accessed through the radio archives on This American Life. And you can just Google Lily and Thomasina. And it is an absolutely stunning interview of a couple of young children who were born anatomically male and decide at a very young age, 7 and 8, to become, to live as girls. And so if anybody's interested in kind of opening that up and hearing a remarkable story, that's something that they can go to.
That is a great episode of This American Life. You can go to thisamericanlife.org and look for it there as well. Let's talk to Aaron in Topeka, 816-235-2888. Aaron, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering what your opinion is regarding the society's views on sexuality with the genders, whereas a man who has had many partners is considered successful, whereas a woman who has had many partners is considered completely unsuccessful in relationships.
Hmm, that's very interesting. Let me ask Charles and Beth to answer this. Charles, in the experience in the Mankind Project, mm-hmm. you, I know that men sort of being able to be honest and about what they need relationally is an important part of the piece. Is that what's at play in these different ways of thinking about multiple partners or multiple relationships?
I think it comes up to courage.
Say more.
If I have the courage to get out of the relationship I'm in because it's not serving me and it's not sustaining me, then I may end up getting out of another relationship. If I have the courage to stay in a relationship, even though it isn't always comfortable, but I'm staying there anyway, then mm-hmm. I can be vulnerable to that. And so the trick is what you said, is to be honest about what's going on instead of subjecting myself to somebody else's needs.
Yeah. Beth, why are men and women seen differently in this category?
Well, I think that sexual relations between folks can be co-opted by gender. So in other words, we see in the relationship the themes of gender taking shape. But it could be a chicken and egg thing. It could also be that the notion of gender comes before. And so we so in a way form a habitus around masculinity or femininity that when we engage one another, we act out roles. Mm-hmm. And in the field of queer studies and gay studies, we see a really wonderful and rich discussion about this issue of active versus passive sexuality and the roles affiliated with that. Active has traditionally been associated with masculinity. Passive has traditionally been associated with femininity, which is why both gay men and women's sexuality sort of interrupts that heteronormative model of active and passive coexisting. And so you've got same-sex partners actually playing roles that had been previously assigned to couples that we would identify as heterosexual.
I'm sorry that we have to leave it there, and I'm sorry to our many callers, Jose and Russ and Robin and Stuart, who we didn't get a chance to talk with today. But I do want to thank our guests, Dr. Beth Berkshire of UMKC and Charles Gruber, who is an elder with the Mankind Project. Thank you both for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can subscribe to our podcast. You can hear this conversation again. You can access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page at kcur.org. We'll also include links to some of the information we've talked about today. Tune in tomorrow for a live KC Currents. They'll be taking your calls about targeted urban redevelopment and what makes a neighborhood thrive and sustainable. That's tomorrow at 10 at KC Currents here on KCUR. Stay tuned now for Up to Date, next with a look at the dangers of distracted driving. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Ross Steinmetz and Sydney Llewellyn. I'm Brian Ellison. This is KCUR.